going to whisper some things to you now about Crunch chocolate bars. Because apparently this whispering thing is a thing that makes you feel things. It's saying something crunchy is coming in the candy wrapper language. Imagine your tongue hiking up those crispy, rocky ridges. Now, drum roll, please.
Wow, that's good. Crunchy, munchy chocolate doesn't whisper.
Turn up the fun with Crunch.
The longest field goal ever attempted is 76 yards. The longest field goal ever missed? Also 76 yards. Why bring this up? Because knowing your limits matters, both when you're kicking a field goal and when you gamble. Betting more than you're comfortable with is like trying a 70-yard field goal. It probably won't go well. So set a limit when you gamble and stick to it. Want more helpful tips like this? Go to keepitfunohio.com for games, quizzes, and lots of ways to keep your gambling from getting out of hand.
This episode is brought to you by Progressive. Most of you aren't just listening right now. You're driving, cleaning, and even exercising. But what if you could be saving money by switching to Progressive? Drivers who save by switching save nearly $750 on average, and auto customers qualify for an average of 7 discounts. Multitask right now. Quote today at Progressive.com. Progressive Casualty Insurance Company and Affiliates. National average 12-month savings of $744 by new customers surveyed who saved with Progressive between June 2022 and May 2023. Potential savings will vary. Discounts not available in all states and situations.
Difficult to keep the line between the past and the present.
You believe that someone out of the past can enter and take possession of a living being?
We may be through with the past, but the past is not through with us.
Welcome back to The Next Picture Show, a movie of the week podcast devoted to a classic film and the way it's shaped our thoughts on a recent release. I'm Tasha Robinson, here again with
Genevieve Kosky,
Scott Tobias,
Keith Phipps.
On the first half of this episode, we discussed the staying power and startling landscapes of Ridley Scott's 1982 cult hit Blade Runner, about a future bounty hunter chasing rogue androids through the startling, far-flung future of 2019. In this half, we'll bring in the new sequel, Blade Runner 2049, and consider how arrival director Denis Villeneuve takes up the story. We should warn you up front that Warner Brothers and Sony have been extremely careful to not spoil pretty much anything about this film for viewers. Generally speaking, that's a positive development, and we're entirely in favor of viewers going into a film as open-minded and unspoiled as possible. But a studio statement read after the film screened listed off things we shouldn't spoil, including the basic nature of many of the characters, things we learn literally on their first introductions, or in some cases in the first minutes of the movie. We were advised that if asked about a certain character, I'm quoting the studio here, please say, "We meet many striking characters over the course of the film, and she is one of them. I wouldn't want to single anyone out. You'll have to see the film for yourself to truly appreciate where everyone fits in." Now, needless to say, if we tried to leave this podcast discussion at that, it would be very short and very repetitive. So we are necessarily going to give away plot points here, including right now in my basic setup of the film. You are warned. If you are not ready to listen to this podcast, feel free to go hang out in your virtual reality paradise with your wooden toy horse until it's safe. Okay, so for the rest of you, Denis Villeneuve's Blade Runner 2049 takes up the action 30 years after the first Blade Runner. The Tyrell Corporation has gone bankrupt and been replaced. There's a new generation of replicants wandering around Earth, obediently doing whatever they're told, and an android called Kay, played by Ryan Gosling, is placidly working for the police, running down and murdering older replicant models. Then his boss, played by Robin Wright, orders him to look into a case that may suggest a replicant has given birth, which should be a physical impossibility. From there, the case expands to take in characters from the first film, a new set of villains, and some ancillary business, including Kay's love affair with a hologram named Joy. What starts out as a mystery becomes a fairly wandering movie that's more about characters and moods than about plot, which you could say about the first Blade Runner as well. But Blade Runner 2049 feels more divided against itself than the first film. Like the original Blade Runner, it has an unusual structure that bucks against the usual conventions of noir movies, mystery films, and science fiction adventures. Also like the original Blade Runner, it's as concerned with urban landscapes and the compositions of crowds as it is with any given character decisions. We'll look at how these two films work together and where they seem to be opposed to each other after this break.
There is an order to things. That's what we do here. We keep order. The world is built on a wall that separates kind. Tell either side there's no wall, you bought a war.
Mm-hmm.
I know.
What do you want?
I want to ask you some questions.
The key to the future
is finally unearthed.
Bring it to me.
They know you're here.
I always told you, you're special. Your story isn't over yet. There's still a page left.
All right, guys, what did you think of Blade Runner 2049?
Okay, you are going to have to help me out with this movie because I don't trust my reaction to it. My reaction to the film, if I'm being completely honest, was that I was bored out of my mind. but I also feel like that is the reaction that a lot of people had to Blade Runner.
Yep.
In that I've come around to seeing the merits of the original Blade Runner, and so that is central to my mistrust of my own reaction. On top of which, there are obviously wonderful things about Blade Runner 2049 that my level of engagement aside, you have to appreciate. I mean, it's freaking beautiful, this movie.
Yeah, I'm still wrestling with this movie. I want to see it again, which is a good thing. I was never bored with it. And it is beautiful. It is a beautiful film. I just never quite saw the point of it. And I have a feeling like a second viewing might change this for me. I'm not really shy about my affection for the first Blade Runner. And this one kind of had... It's going to sound worse than I really mean it, but kind of had like a Matrix Reloaded feel to me, where like the first one is visually amazing and raises the interesting philosophical questions. And to stay compelling, the sequel has to like come up with like sort of these strange, twisty variations on those philosophical questions that are probably less interesting than the questions raised in the first one. I don't know though. I think a second viewing might change that. But there's things that stuck with me that really kind of bugged me about it. Like Robin Wright is quite good in the movie, but all her monologues about how there's a wall and we need to keep the wall up. And if the wall falls down, chaos breaks out. It's like, well, I think you're spelling the themes out of this out a little too explicitly in the way the first one never would. And in a way that the rest of the film doesn't. But it does it in such a way that it's kind of like it's too explicit for this movie. I don't know.
I mean, you know what it wasn't too explicit for? A Few Good Men, where we first got the wall speech.
Yeah.
Genevieve?
I think I'm a little more positive on it than the two of you are, which I think is maybe correlated to me being somewhat less enamored of the original Blade Runner. I still like it quite a bit, but I'm just not like crazy passionate about it. Nor am I crazy passionate about Blade Runner 2049, but I liked it quite a bit, and I did find it in general engaging throughout. And I think just in terms of kind of what we were talking about in the first half about like there's not that much that actually happens in Blade Runner. He doesn't like actually do that much detective work. Like there is a mystery here. There is something that is unfolding throughout and that kept me engaged in the story in a way that I'm never really engaged in the story of Blade Runner. I agree that it is trying to do way too much and there's a lot that gets dropped and it does bring to the surface a lot of what Blade Runner allows to kind of percolate beneath it. You know, if Blade Runner is, you know, still waters run deep, this is rough, choppy waters run deep, you know?
And then Harrison Ford almost drowns in
it. Literally rough, choppy waters. Yeah.
But I mean, it's so freaking gorgeous. Like I could just look at this movie the way that I could just look at Blade Runner. Well, I guess, and listen to it, because it's also aurally impressive, albeit in a different way, because this is a Hans Zimmer score. So you know what that means. But yeah, I mean, I also want to revisit it again. I don't know if I want to sit through almost 3 hours of it again. Like, this is definitely not a tight movie, and could probably stand to have two or three plot threads just kind of chopped off completely. Mm-hmm. But I'm pro Blade Runner 2049.
It has a strong story until it doesn't. I do like
it has third act problems.
Yeah, I do like the very end of this film quite a bit. Mm-hmm. But yeah, the third act is, to me, kind of disastrous. I feel like a lot of things get raised and then dropped. I had a hard time following what the motivations of some of the characters were toward the end. Mm-hmm. And again, there's things I honestly just don't understand about the final act of this film.
Yeah, I think it peaks in Vegas and then it takes a steep drop until that final scene.
I want to know what Tasha thinks. I don't think we've heard. She weighed in. Have you weighed in, Tasha?
I have not weighed in.
Last time I talked about this movie, you were nauseated from the rumble seats we were forced to sit in.
We got to talk about the rumble seats.
The rumble seats. That is entirely, wow, I just had the word rumbled straight out of my mind. Scott Tobias, what is your word for stuff that doesn't matter?
Extra-textual.
Thank you. The rumble seats are extra-textual.
Not Scott Tobias. I just knew the word.
You're playing Scott Tobias on this podcast. Scott, I feel like we need one of our infrequent high fives. You described my reaction to the movie so perfectly that, and this rarely happens, but no, I'm completely simpatico there. I was bored. I was really bored. And yet pieces of this movie keep resurfacing in my mind over and over and over. I keep coming back to things and thinking, well, I'm not sure I appreciated that at the time. That was really cool. And I really want to see the movie again, despite the fact that I found my first viewing so tedious. Yes, it's really visually gorgeous in a lot of ways. Although, so Emily Ishida, my former editor at The Verge, just wrote a really interesting piece about fantasy giant women in science fiction, the imagery of the giant woman and how it keeps recurring in science fiction. And that was one of the many things in this movie that was just a huge turnoff for me, just the fetishization of the giant naked woman, the giant naked glowing woman hovering over everything. Or looming over everything in Vegas, where we just kept getting these dislocated, fetishy body parts of women.
Oh, okay.
I found that just really creepy. But also the giant glowing joy.
Yeah, which is a nod to the original film, too, which also had giant, you know, neon billboard women, too.
Oh, sure.
You know, and so much of this movie is calling to the original Blade Runner, including, while we're getting extra-textual, the first scene of this movie where Ryan Gosling's character, Kay, hunts down a replicant played by Dave Bautista named Sapper Morton. Sure. That scene is taken from one of the scrapped opening scenes of the original Blade Runner, right? Am I correct here? Like where he...
I had not read that.
Yeah. Like I watched the first half hour of the 3.5 hour making of documentary before God. I came here. I wasn't able to get it all in, but I did get to like the storyboarded original introduction of Deckard, where he is like sitting in this cabin and there's soup boiling and he kills this replicant and we don't know why. That's the reveal that it's a replicant. It's structured exactly the way it was storyboarded in Blade Runner.
Okay, that's kind of fascinating.
Yeah.
I cannot in any way fault Denis Villeneuve's like fascination with or respect for the original Blade Runner. Yeah. I think it shows through here over and over that he was paying attention, that he really passionately cares about things like the Atari logo and the Pan Am logo in the background. Like, he cares about all of these themes. And I think to some degree, Blade Runner 2049 does feel like he's aware that all of these things were undercurrents that maybe weren't fully developed or fully expressed. Yeah. And so he wants to both bring them out more overtly and not have anybody say, gosh, I just don't know what it means to be human. Perhaps there is some way that we could explore that, even though I myself am not human. Like he doesn't want to overplay it more than he has to. So I think there are still some like fairly subtle things here about the whole question of humanity and the nature of what it means to be human. But at the same time, this film does need an edit. I'm really curious about the things that you don't understand about the third act. There are things that completely baffle me.
What happens to the rebellion? Yeah. Where does Jared Leto go? Does he go anywhere? Yeah, it's just a lot going on that I was not following all that well. Maybe it's just it was so deep into the night at that point. But I also felt like the movie had done a pretty good job at like moving me along in a coherent fashion, and then stop doing.
Were you being jostled by the seat? Was that the problem?
Well, oh my God! All right. Let's talk about the seats.
You know, it is a part from the movie we got to talk about. We all saw this movie in a Dolby Atmos outfitted theater. Here in Chicago.
It's specifically AMC Prime, because apparently there are Atmos theaters that don't have the rumble seats.
Sure.
Yeah, Atmos is really just about sound,
surround
a very
sound.
Vivid sound, yeah. which another theater we go to and here picture. Called Icon has yeah. it. It's great.
It looked great. Movie sounded great, except for it had a very deep bass, which I like. I like a deep bass. Turn that subwoofer up. Sounds great. Except when the bass would rumble, the seat would rumble along with it.
Like hard. You're sitting in a roller coaster level rumbling.
Yeah, kind of like, you know, one of those motion control rides, you know, and it was very annoying, and there was a lot of it.
It was
throughout the film.
So distracting.
You actually got a headache, right?
I got a headache, and I am not subject to motion sickness. I am the kind of person, I can read on a train, I can read on a bus. I have never had a problem with motion sickness. I walked out of this film so nauseated, I did think I was going to throw up.
So we're to say, cool it. Cool it with that whole deep bass rumble seat thing.
That is one of the reasons I think I could stand to rewatch this film. Is it literally felt like an army of toddlers kicking my chair throughout, I would say, roughly 80% of the film.
No.
It was so distracting.
Totally.
You watched it with that too, Scott?
I did. Yeah. I did. I'm behind you. That is another reason why I throw my own reaction to the film into question. Yeah.
But getting back on track, am I wrong to be confused about those things in the third act of this movie?
I think Jared Leto's motivations are really confusing.
Yeah.
I think that it is obvious that he wants to play God and cross lines that no one should cross, and then eventually his creations are going to come for him because that's how science movies work. But apart from that, he has a lot of big windy speechifying that reminded me a lot of The Architect in the latter Matrix movies. Mm-hmm. And just that sense of, here's a big heady philosophical thing that is maybe is tied into the concept of the movie, but is in no way interesting to the action of it. And he talks and he talks and he talks and he talks. And the whole time I'm thinking, yes, but what do you want? And then he produces his big grandstanding effect, which Scott may give away. I don't particularly want to. But when he does it, it's supposed to be a hugely jarring emotional moment. And for me, it was like, yeah, but how does this further his goals that we don't understand? What does he want to happen here?
Yeah, like at a very basic level, what does the maker of replicants stand to gain from self-perpetuating replicants? His business is making replicants. Like, why does he want that?
Here we get
He's replacing himself by automation.
Well, here we get into Alien Covenant business, or just the recent Ridley Scott Alien sequels in general. We're back to that feeling of, if I create life that can create life, if I create life that has intelligence in the way of normal biological life, then I am a god, mm-hmm. and I deserve to be elevated to godhood, which is a thing that comes up a lot in movies about science in the future and is very rarely done in a way that I think is interesting, and certainly not here.
I also didn't find the performance all that great in a film that is otherwise nicely acted. I mean, people reflexively don't like Jared Leto. I don't want to be one of those people, but I didn't care for him in this film.
No, I think it definitely played into what people think makes Jared Leto performances bad.
Yeah, this is a man that sends dead rats and used condoms to his coworkers because he thinks it helps his method. I reflexively dislike him.
I think he single-handedly just killed
method acting.
It's over now.
It needed to die.
I kept thinking, and there's a scene where he comes up to Deckard, played by Harrison Ford, and touches him and says, I'm so happy to meet you. I've always wanted to meet you. And I'm like, is this actually in the film, or is this an outtake of Jared Leto meeting Harrison Ford? Because he has this look on his face like, get away from me, kid.
Maybe it's meant to parallel that moment where Deckard is trying to make out with Rachel and she's trying to escape.
Yeah.
It's just, it's all a gender reverse thing. Like, this is how uncomfortable you made her, you jerk.
One thing I would say about this film and my reaction to it is that so much of it is so reflective of the first film that it feels trapped by it. And I would say that by far my favorite moment of the film, my favorite sequence of the film, is all the stuff in Las Vegas, because I feel like it's visually extends the world of the film so much. It's such a, I mean, the film is beautiful all the way through, but you don't feel like you're getting a really souped up version of something you've already seen before, that this is a new place and a new environment. And then you get this relationship that starts to develop between Kay and Deckard, and all that seems exciting and not so tethered to the original film.
I think one of the most striking moments of the film is where the two of them confront each other in basically a virtual cabaret that's malfunctioning.
Mm-hmm. Mm-hmm.
And we have these Marilyn Monroe and Elvis and other characters blinking in and out of existence while the soundtrack blares the music that they're playing, and then it cuts in and out. And it's unsettling. It's very disjointed deliberately because the system around them is breaking down. And like so many things in this film, I found that fascinating. And then it just seemed to overextend. I felt it went on twice as long as it needed to make its point, to put us in the moment, to actually play out the action of the fight that they were playing out. And it reached a level of tedium for me.
I never got that tedium, but just the Vegas sequence in general speaks to something that I think this film takes Blade Runner a step further, I think, in a positive way, is showing us this world beyond Los Angeles. You know, we go to several places outside of the city limits. You know, in addition to Vegas, there's the protein farm, I guess, that Dave Bautista is at. And then there's San Diego, which is a literal dump now, you know.
like, it's a nice city, too. It's
yeah.
Sorry, San Diego.
So I just kind of what you were speaking to in the first half, Scott, about how there's just a lot left to viewers to like mull or wonder about this world. There's a lot left unsaid. This says more about the world in a way that like I found satisfying. You know, mm-hmm. I love world building in general, and I liked what this movie added to the world.
The thing that I most loved was the relationship between Kay and Joy, mm-hmm. his iteration, his copy of this software that is meant to please you and bring you everything that you want and satisfy you. And it's very much, it feels like a riff on Her, the movie.
A little bit too much at times.
Especially with the surrogate, the sex surrogate
part. Absolutely agreed. But at the same time, you know, it does visual things that Her couldn't do because Samantha is not a physical visual presence. The way Joy is perpetually trying to touch him and can't and has to bring in a surrogate for that, I found visually fascinating, especially when she brings in the surrogate and they don't quite overlap, but she keeps trying to make it happen. That whole sequence I found really interesting. But even more so, the idea that because Kay is a replicant and people seem to know he's a replicant, though I don't know how, just casual encounters of people on the street call him a skin job and insult him and yell at him. The fact that he is just this loathed creature that cannot form a relationship with other people or other replicants, and so he attaches himself to this virtual presence that is designed to love him, I find that to be a really poignant science fiction concept that I think the movie carries out really well. And the scenes where they're alone together and the movie is about the two of them are the most compelling in the movie for me.
By the way, Joy is a character Tasha mentioned in the intro that we couldn't reveal the nature of her character.
She's a hologram. We know because we see the hologram emitter before we see her. She's introduced as a hologram.
I think, you know, the expiration date may be up on those, those spoiler warnings.
I'm mostly just, I find it fascinating that we were read off this list of things that we weren't supposed to cover and that it was so all encompassing. I find that just fascinating.
And in the suggested language, please.
Yeah, the point where they scripted what we were supposed to say if anybody asked us about the film is hilarious.
You know, we do meet a lot of fascinating characters, and she is one of them.
We've all kind of covered like a favorite aspect of this film that is doing so many different things, except you, Keith. Like, do you have a standout moment or scene or thought?
I mean, I'm gonna have to say the Las Vegas sequence as well, and just him wandering around and this sort of this sense of Las Vegas that's gotten even more decadent than our Vegas, like in part because of these sort of giant sexualized statues and elements like that. I mean, one thing this film does really well is rather than starting from scratch, it ages the world we saw in Blade Runner 30 years in a really convincing way. I thought that was one of the best things about it. Although I think it's less interesting looking than Blade Runner. I think the Los Angeles of this film is a little, I didn't want to wander around it the way I want to wander around the original Blade Runner's Los Angeles.
It's probably true. One thing that just occurred to me now about Vegas and how striking it is and how it extends the visual language of the film is just the idea that the desert is reclaiming that city, which is interesting, right? I mean, like that's an interesting thought about Vegas, because Vegas, as we know it, does everything it can to keep from reminding you that it is in the middle of the desert. It's all electricity and modernity and is in defiance of nature, and now nature is coming back to reclaim it. I really like that aspect of that sequence.
I like the giant dump too. I just the miles of garbage piled on top of each other. That was a striking image as well.
This is a film of very striking images. I thought that some of the stuff done around virtual reality or virtual memory in the film was really visually interesting. It's sometimes visually interesting in a very show-off-y, we have a big budget, we can create whatever we want here kind of way. But even so, I guess I just overall find the way that people interact with virtual reality and augmented reality in this film to be pretty interesting, because it's both visually dynamic and thematically rich, thematically interesting. It's explored in a very interesting way. What memory, you're talking about memory, what that actually means for these characters. And that is something that is kind of drawn out of Blade Runner, this idea of artificially implanted memories. But the new film expands it to a greater degree by figuring out sort of what that looks like, what it looks like to build them, what it looks like to experience them, what it looks like to discover that they're false.
Well, and it makes it the center of its mystery, you know, like this memory of a wooden horse that propels Kay through the story.
I thought she was great too. Carla Drury, who played Anna, the dream maker. She was in Wetlands and Mortgage for America.
Yes, Wetlands. Holy smokes.
Yeah. Like her performance was like at a slightly different tone than everyone else in the movie, in a way that I really like. There was a, I don't want to say it was funny, but there was a lightness to it in a movie just characterized by very heavy performance
it
styles.
Needed that.
You know, yeah, it did for sure.
It needed a couple, it has a couple nice moments.
Yeah, Mackenzie Davis kind of gives a little bit of that energy too, although her character is a little more serious.
And Gosling has, like, he carries himself in a very light way, even when the material is heavy. And I thought that was...
I thought he was great here. I really enjoyed Ryan Gosling in this.
Yeah, it was well cast.
I generally do. I mean, he's a very rich performer, I think.
He's got a sad smile. I think that serves him well. It serves him well in something like La La Land. It serves him well in something like this as well.
I miss having a little bit of that, like the Harrison Ford smirk, like in that central character, that sort of feeling of swagger. Because you really do get the feeling that Kay is... burdened by life, is burdened by the things that he is asked to do that he has no choice to do. There's a kind of creepy sexual harassment moment with him and Robin Wright, where Robin Wright is basically like, I got a bottle of booze and I could order you to do anything that I want. And it's creepy and unsettling, but you kind of get the feeling that that's sort of just what he's used to in his life, is this feeling of being at everyone's beck and call. And we're told the new order of replicants obey without question, but we see the weight of that on him, I think.
I think Harrison Ford's performance is interesting in that I feel like his Deckard here is a lot different than his Deckard in the original Blade Runner. And I think we can maybe talk about that more in the next section.
That is a really good point. We can talk about both how the two Deckards mesh with each other and kind of how old Deckard and new Kay are similar characters in a way. So we'll be right back after this break to talk about the connections between Blade Runner and Blade Runner 2049.
This episode is brought to you by Progressive Insurance. Most of you listening right now are probably multitasking. Yep, while you're listening to me talk, you're probably also driving, cleaning, exercising, or maybe even grocery shopping. But if you're not in some kind of moving vehicle, there's something else you can be doing right now. Getting an auto quote from Progressive Insurance. It's easy, and you could save money by doing it right from your phone. Drivers who save by switching to Progressive save nearly $750 on average. And auto customers qualify for an average of 7 discounts. Discounts for having multiple vehicles on your policy, being a homeowner, and more. So just like your favorite podcast, Progressive will be with you 24/7, 365 days a year, so you're protected no matter what. Multitask right now. Quote your car insurance at Progressive.com to join the over 28 million drivers who trust Progressive. Progressive Casualty Insurance Company and Affiliates. National average 12-month savings of $744 by new customers surveyed who saved with Progressive between June 2022 and May 2023. Potential savings will vary. Discounts not available in all states and situations.
The nickel is for the colonial ships. Closest any of them or any of us is going to get to that grand life off-world. So come on now. What sword do you have in mind? Because I got all kinds. No.
I'm not buying.
No. This is just my game, and I play it fair. No. I mean, bigger than you. Bigger than you were trying to shut me down. Bigger than you, and they were men at that.
Now it's time for Connections, where we bring these two films together and talk about all the things they have in common. Why don't we start off with that whole Decker versus Decker thing, Genevieve?
Yeah, I mean, I actually liked Harrison Ford's performance here, I think, more than I did in the original Blade Runner, and maybe because it does have a little bit of that quality that we discussed is what you think of when you think of a Harrison Ford performance that is absent in Blade Runner. There is a little bit more of, not exactly swagger to Deckard here, because he is hiding out. He's not in necessarily in control of his situation in any way, but you get the sense that this character has been through things and has changed, and that there is more to him, whereas I feel like the Deckard of original Blade Runner is a little more of a blank, and like you project things onto him that the performance doesn't necessarily give you. And I think here the performance is giving you things about the character.
I think young Deckard thinks he's out of F's to give.
Yeah.
And this old Deckard realizes he has even fewer F's to give now.
That is a beautiful way to put it, Keith. Thank you.
And I did not get an explicit rating by phrasing it in such a way.
Well done. That's a good point. And he's not the lead of this movie. Yeah. This is not his story. You know, we find him apart from the world of the film, and it affects him. And I'm glad that that's been thought through. That those differences have been thought through, you know, both on a script and directorial level and on a performance level, because you're right, they are not the same performance.
How great would it be? I know it would be a marketing disaster, not that this film necessarily performed that well at the box office, but how great would it be to not know that Harrison Ford was in this movie? To have him show up in the third act. And,
you wait for a long time.
I know.
How long do you wait for him to show up?
I would have been expecting it. I mean, if nothing else, because of Force Awakens, I was honestly expecting him to show up here and die.
Yeah.
And I'm expecting Indiana Jones 5 for him to show up and die. I feel like Harrison Ford just wants to kill off all of his legacy characters.
Yeah. And regarding Henry too, he shows up. Wait, no. Go ahead.
One of the things I find really interesting about like looking at these two films together is that Rachel is kind of a femme fatale, but she's also kind of a classic like damsel in distress. She finds out that she's a replicant. She doesn't know what to do with it. She is now under a death sentence. She comes to a dude. The dude is like, let's have sex. She's like, I don't think I'm into this. He's like, I don't care. And then she trails him around for the rest of the movie and is hapless and cannot really think or act for herself. She is an object. In Blade Runner 2049, I would argue that Harrison Ford is more or less an object. He tries to fight off Kay and he kind of can't, and then he kind of gives up, and then he spends the rest of the movie being hauled around by the arm by one person or the other. He gets kidnapped, he gets threatened in a kind of brutal and maybe a little sexual way, and then he ends up tied up in a van watching somebody else fight for his freedom. The role that he is in this movie is a classic woman in an 80s action movie. Like, he has practically no agency. Hmm. And the more that developed, the more fascinating I found it.
That is really interesting, because I was kind of thinking that the Deckard-Rachel relationship in Blade Runner had kind of imported over onto Kay and Joy. And reviewing those relationships as kind of speaking to each other. But that is a really cool interpretation that I like a lot.
It didn't come up for me until we were watching him, like in the, we kind of referenced the storm-tossed waters. He spends that entire sequence just waiting to be rescued.
Yep. See, it's this sort of thing that, again, makes me mistrust my own reaction. Mm-hmm. Like, that these things after the fact that maybe I did not acknowledge that I should have.
I think that we'll all have a different reaction to it the second time
hopefully
around.
I can't be jostled. No jostling me.
We will all go to a non-jostle theater and see it together.
I was hoping at least one of us would be of the it's even better than the first one camp. Mm. And we're not. But I find that reaction fascinating. I don't agree with it. I really don't like that a lot of the writing around this has been a chance to kind of throw the first movie under a bus in some ways. You know, I don't like the Blade Runner was not very good. This movie is much better than the original because the original is not very good. I'm not a fan of that school of thought. But it is interesting to me that there are people for whom this will be the equivalent of Blade Runner. You know, maybe I'll be a convert to one of these days. I'm not sure. I do want to see it again. I don't think there's as much going on here though.
Man, respect your elders is what, like, I mean, as far as like the original film, I mean, come on, the whole look of the movie, the whole conceit is that was done before. You got to show some respect.
Yeah, I'm sorry. I feel that's a little like saying Alien Covenant is better than Alien.
Now, I want to talk to you about that. No,
I think that both of these movies question what it means to be human. and both of them kind of address the idea that it maybe is your behavior. But then 2049 kind of goes into this whole apparently coming out of a womb is super important. Mm-hmm. I'm really wondering why it doesn't interrogate that impulse a little more. Or maybe it does, in that by the end, perhaps we come to see Kay as human and having a soul regardless of the fact that he did not come out of a womb. I find his almost religious belief in that concept really fascinating, since we're kind of given to understand that everything that he is, his memories, his mental processes, was supposedly programmed into him. Where did he come up with that idea?
I mean, the first scene, Dave Bautista's character, Spooner Oldham or whatever.
Spooner Olderman? Sapper Morton.
Sapper Morton, yeah. You know, he talks about it as a miracle. And I think to me, it's less that this replicant has a soul where others doesn't, than this is proof that replicants can have souls. That can be people, too. And I almost feel like in some ways, this film treats the do replicants have souls, or replicants on the level of humanity, as kind of a settled issue, and then moves that on to the artificial intelligence of Joy. That's a question, then. It's less a matter of how replicants reflect on humanity than how this other artificial being reflects on both replicants and humans.
I can't get over the fact that the two most prominent forms of female AI in this movie are named Joy and Love. Mm-hmm. It seems like the whole movie is kind of like commenting on like the ephemeral experiences that define humanity. The first Blade Runner was very fixated on the idea of memories, and memory is what makes replicants more human than human, or is what gives them that extra push into humanity. And Rachel discovering her memories aren't real is what causes her to question her own existence. And in Blade Runner 2049, like, the question of memories is a settled thing, you know? Replicants are aware of what their memories are. So I think Kay's kind of wrestling over this idea of a soul is sort of like the next logical progression of that questioning the replicants have of like what makes them human-esque.
For me, I guess the original film's idea that somehow like the choices that you make are what make you human is so much more resonant and interesting to me than the idea that childbirth makes you human. The whole miracle of childbirth thing in 2049 sits really poorly with me for a variety of reasons.
See, I don't think it's about childbirth necessarily so much as being created by two of your own kind, or like right. being created
or
by
one of your own kind,
or one of your own kind, yes, but like not being created by human hands as a slave, being born into the world as a free being.
Organic beat.
It's a next step.
But the whole miracle thing, they hit it so hard, like starting with Dave Bautista in the opening scene and carrying on through the revolution, the idea that this is a miracle. And to me, the choices that people make, that is always an interesting and resonant thing. Like in cinema, it becomes hugely important. It so often drives the plot. The choices that you make define who you are, but they also model a behavior for people. You know, you have a choice. You have options in the world. The things that you choose to do are important. You don't choose to get born from a replicant. Like the least interesting thing to me is where that character like originated. And then when you pile on the sort of weird, like, messianic qualities of born of a replicant / born of a virgin, and then you pile into the way that everybody sort of worships her, and then you pile in the fact that Rachel died in childbirth, so we never have to contend with that character on screen, all of that just adds up into this weird fetishization. For somebody who says fetishization as often as I do, you would think I would learn how to say it. But there's so much of that around like motherhood and the ability to reproduce in this movie. And I find it both interfering with the interesting parts of the plot and just not very interesting in and of itself.
Yeah, I don't know. I think it just comes down to the motivations or the emotions behind one's creation. You know, and whether it comes out of a place of capitalism and consumerism and slave labor or a place of love and joy, you know, between two beings who love each other. So I think that's maybe the contrast that is being grappled with there, though obviously not in a very straightforward or satisfying manner.
As with so many other things. Yeah, I maybe if they did actually grapple with the whole love thing, because to me, we're just coming out of that weird, uncomfortable, rapey scene.
Yeah. Not having any idea of like Rachel and Deckard's relationship after the events of Blade Runner is like kind of hinders that, I think.
Yeah. And then the fact that he left her like immediately for what is presented as good reasons, but emotionally, I just didn't buy into it. The whole jump from we don't know much about their relationship because there isn't much there in the first film to we don't know much about their relationship because it's over in the second film leaves a huge gap in what's supposed to be in some kind of way an important part of all of the story. We can jump to a variety of less heavy and miserable things. We should talk about the cinematography in these two movies. Roger Deakins in the new film and
Jordan Cronenweth,
who was, among other things, he was the DP on Altered States and Stop Making Sense. Did a lot of music videos, especially with Madonna and U2. Peggy Sue Got Married. I mean, he's not a hugely prolific cinematographer, but he did some really memorable stuff.
Well, he was on Alien 3. He was David Fincher's photographer, and I think was ultimately fired for being too slow.
I think so, yeah.
Yeah, so I think he was a very deliberate worker. And then Fincher would go on to work with his son, right?
Jeff Cronenweth, yeah.
Yeah.
And he died relatively young, 61, so we might have gotten more films with him if that were not the case.
He did a good job. Looks great. Blade Runner.
I mean, both of these films look great.
Oh, God, I know. And I love that Blade Runner 2049 continues Villeneuve's interest in landscapes. He loves his signature shot is that overhead of whatever, you know, very textured surface is.
The opening sequence of this movie where Kay is flying over that protein farm and it's like a horrible, like, white patchwork quilt of desolation and... It's a really fascinating like way into this movie, especially contrasted with Blade Runner, which opens with blackness and light in this incredibly striking way. And it feels very much like the yin to the yang of Blade Runner. There.
I'm glad they went that way, too. You open on Los Angeles and you're just setting yourself up to be compared.
Yeah, it's one of the most famous opening sequences in film history. You really don't want to try to top it or replicate it.
Yeah, and Deakins brings a lot of different looks to the film, too. And I feel like his Los Angeles kind of has the same look and feel up to a point of the original, but then those excursions away from Los Angeles, everyone is a little different, and Las Vegas especially. I mean that is among his career best moments was that Las Vegas stretch.
And you know, I dissed the whole sequence where Kay is talking to, or really just sort of being advertised at, by the giant glowing woman who is an advertisement for the Joy
operating
software,
system. Yeah.
Basically. But I mean, you can't fault how that looks. The inner glow of the hologram character and the bright pink skin and the blue hair. And then the way she just sort of towers over him and everything that is not her is just this sort of like dark, very exquisitely detailed, but sort of just dark shadows and shapes. I mean, it's the things that Deakins does with light are always impressive. And some of the things that he does here in the contrast between neon light and the darkness of the world, the buildings, the architecture are just really, really impressive.
At the same time, 2049 doesn't have as much of the shadowy quality that I associate with noir. Like I see very little noir in 2049.
I think it's less of a noir film, though.
Yeah, exactly. Like I think to the extent it's there, it is there because it is picking up like visual cues from Blade Runner. But it is very much, I don't even know that there is a genre that I would connect its style to specifically the way that I would connect Blade Runner to noir style.
Or pure science fiction,
I guess. Yeah.
Or kind of like an 80s, 90s, you know, police thriller in some ways.
Yeah. It definitely has the look of a much more action-heavy film than it is, yeah. You know?
Yeah, sorry that it has in common with Blade Runner.
Yeah.
But I did appreciate that aspect of the film because as much as you could criticize 2049 for being too much of a kind of an overlay of what we'd seen before or taking up themes or in subplots and doing them again or highlighting them in some way, I think there is a real effort on Deakins' part and on Villeneuve's part to extend the visual language of the film and make it something new, or at least more expansive and, you know, exciting than what we'd seen before. And that's a hard thing to do, given the reputation of the first film. And I think the film pulls it off quite well.
I think it carries through to the music too, which I don't know how deep we'll go into this connection. So I'm just going to like peg it on to cinematography and,
oh, sure.
and make mm-hmm. this just connection about style in general. But we have Hans Zimmer taking over for the Vangelis score, which has echoes throughout 2049, but is very different in its way and does move it into a different tonal direction. Because the thing that I always like, that always stands out to me in that Vangelis score, is kind of the synthy saxophone mm-hmm. line throughout. And just like, because, you know, that saxophone is just such a detective noir cliche or touch point, you know, and like to have it filtered through this very synthy sound is just really kind of spot on for Blade Runner. Mm-hmm. And then in Blade Runner 2049, you have so much of kind of the modern blockbuster action movie, just like rumble, you know, kind of aggressiveness, you know, that I think defines a lot of modern sci-fi and action films.
So. It's still artful. I mean, the ambiance, it's like an ambiance. It's so thick in 2049, whereas Vangelis has that romantic score.
The thing that strikes me most about the music is that the Vangelis score is it's very moody. Mm-hmm. It's very, as you say, just evocative of that sad trombone in the rain. Whereas because of the rumble seats in part, what struck me most about 2049 was the bass. Mm-hmm. There is an incredible amount of low end in that movie that I think if the seats weren't shaking, it would just sort of come across as like this kind of like dull, low rumble of discontent running through the entire film, this sense of ominousness.
Yeah.
And it's one of my big problems with the rumble seats was it is impossible to take ominousness seriously when you're like listening to all of these little servos violently
where it
shaking
feels like
your seat
is farting.
Yeah, exactly.
This was my least favorite S.E. Hinton novel, rumble seats.
I don't know if it'll ever surface, but I would love to hear the original score to this. Johan Johansson, who did the music for Prisoners and Sicario, did a whole score for this that was not used. Hans Zimmer was brought in. His music in Arrival especially was so key to that. I'd love to at least sample it and see what it was like.
That is fascinating. I guess before we head out on this one and go cry in the rain, as is our wont, one of the things that connects these movies most for me is, as I said, I guess, the idea that what you do is what matters, as opposed to how you were designed, where you came from, what your origins are. But it seems to me that both of these movies end up being about what makes life meaningful. If you have a very short lifespan, if it's defined for you, and all of us have a lifespan that is defined for us, not entirely by our own choice.
Not me. I'm going to live forever.
Okay. Everybody except Genevieve, who's immortal. And that has not been proven wrong yet. So
yep.
Probably true. So I think that both of these movies, especially given where they end with Roy's choice regarding Deckard and with Kay's choice regarding his purpose, kind of come down to the idea that you have a short period of life. You need to do something to define it. You need to make that life meaningful. And I think that they both actually take that up in a really strong and interesting way. I mean, I think one of the most interesting things about the original Blade Runner is what Roy chooses to do at the end.
I think one of the most interesting things about this one is Kay or Joe. I'm not sure what's going through his head at the end of this movie. I don't think we'll ever know, but maybe he feels like he's made the right choices and he's contributed in some way to furthering the replicant existence, or maybe he feels like he's wasted it all. Like I think, just as like, I don't think we know his final thoughts on Joy as to whether or not that love was real or just programming. I don't think we'll really know what he's thinking at the end.
Really? I got a very strong sense that interaction with the big version of the hologram, where she uses some of the same words, and it obviously emotionally hits him. I thought that was where he made the decision that maybe this love wasn't real, it was programmed, and he has to do something to define himself. And in those last moments, I really got a sense of like accomplishment and achievement and satisfaction from him that were very similar to Roy's last
seconds. Yeah, that's more or less where I am too, but I don't think the film spells it out for you, and I appreciate that.
I think there's a lot in both of these movies that isn't spelled out, then we can all probably appreciate it more for that. Well, Blade Runner is available on DVD and Blu-ray in many, many forms, which you can read about all of the different cuts online, though, as Keith said, there are only a couple that really matter. It's also available for digital rental on the usual streaming services. Blade Runner 2049 is currently in theaters, but its box office performance has been somewhat dire, and it may be on its way out sooner than expected. We'll be right back with our usual recommendation segment, Your Next Picture Show. Finally, it's time to catch each other up on films or film-related items we've seen in the interim since our last podcast. We call this Your Next Picture Show in the hopes that it'll put some interesting choices on your radar. Scott, what in the film world has been good for you lately?
Well, the film I'm most excited about, and I is this my favorite film of the year? It seems absurd to think so, but I saw and really loved Brawl in Cell Block 99. This is the new film by S. Craig Zahler, who had previously done a film called Bone Tomahawk, a Western with Kurt Russell that's got a lot of acclaim for good reason. He's a director who really, very deep in his bones, understands, you know, grindhouse cinema, exploitation cinema, but also is not wrapped up in homage. He's somebody who has his own style and his own approach. You know, both of these films, for example, are like 130 some minutes long, so that makes a difference too. And in any case, this stars Vince Vaughn, who's really never been better or more interesting as a former boxer who loses his job at a towing company and takes a job as a drug dealer, basically, or a distributor of a runner, of a drug runner. He gets involved in a job that goes wrong with a couple of guys that he did want to be involved with to begin with. He takes a noble action that gets him in very, very serious trouble. It lands him in jail, for one, but then it also results in him having to do some extraordinary things in order to save his wife and his unborn child. And boy, it is a very harsh film. It just like Bone Tomahawk was. Bone Tomahawk has maybe one of the more notorious scenes of violence of the last, you know, 10 years or so. But it gives you so much good, vivid stuff. I mean, you have Don Johnson and Udo Kier and all these wonderful character actors in the movie. And then he'll just spend a lot of time on things that movies don't usually spend a lot of time with, like getting to know what a medium security prison is like and what the process is of being there. It's just a fascinating film that seems driven by a very distinct sensibility. It reminds me a little bit of a director like Quentin Tarantino or, you know, Rob Zombie on his best days, who really has internalized a certain type of filmmaking and is doing more than just paying homage to it. He's extending a filmmaking tradition in a meaningful way. So I really like this movie. It is obviously not for the faint of heart. It is, you know, there are some extraordinarily violent scenes in the film, but totally up my alley. Brawl in Cell Block 99. You can watch it on VOD at this point. It really only got a very small release theatrically and then immediately went to VOD on the 13th of October.
Yeah, I want to back Scott up on this one. I actually saw this at Fantastic Fest. I was thinking of you the whole time, Scott. We had a conversation on Twitter about this. I was the whole time I was thinking Scott is either going to love this or he's going to disappoint me. I wouldn't compare him to Tarantino because it might give people the wrong impression, because Tarantino is such a the man drools over his violence. Like, all of his films have kind of a overexcited quality to me. Mm. And this film is so chilly and intellectual and, like, quietly intelligent in a way that I find really fascinating. Do not go in expecting a brawl in Cell Block 99 to happen, like, really early on. It is absolutely the last act.
I mean, you've got this incredible title, this like the most B-movie title imaginable, and yet it's still totally understated. Like, Brawl doesn't even come close to describe what goes on in Cell Block 99.
It's true, but he makes you wait the entire movie for it, which is one of the many reasons I really enjoyed this film. It surprised me on all levels. I actually interviewed Zahler for The Verge, and one of the things I found out that made me even happier was that there's no digital effects in this movie. Everything that he does is a practical effect. All of the brawling, all of the Cell Block 99ing, and all of the extreme violence, he did as much as possible on the set, on the day. Like, that's his aesthetic. really like this film.
Should win Best Makeup at the very least.
Genevieve, what do you have for us?
Okay, well, I was going to recommend a movie that I absolutely loved, but I think it is going to be our next pairing inspiration. So instead, I will recommend a movie that I liked quite a bit. it's a new HBO documentary called Spielberg, which, as you might glean from the title, is about one Steven Spielberg. This is sort of a biopic by way of career retrospective approach that I think works really well for Spielberg in particular, because he is such a personal filmmaker, even though he's known for working in this big blockbuster paradigm that he more or less defined. But formally, this is a pretty traditional documentary. Sorry, Scott. It's packed with film footage and many, many, many famous talking heads, most prominently among them Spielberg himself, who sat for extensive interviews with director Susan Lacy, but was otherwise uninvolved with this film's production. As such, it is a pretty admiring portrait, but it's not quite at the level of like hagiography. It does engage with some of the criticisms Spielberg has received as a director, namely his sentimental streak and his early reputation as a studio director among the more aesthetically inclined movie brats of the late 70s and early 80s, most of whom show up here. But it approaches those criticisms and everything else about Spielberg's work in the context of his personal history and his growth as both a director and a person. One of the film's most engaging threads to me was him slowly convincing himself that he had to make Schindler's List after years of avoiding it, and how that decision dovetailed with him embracing his Judaism after years spent feeling embarrassed about it growing up. You know, this is Spielberg, so it's not going to be a scandalous or salacious account, but I do think it's a very engaging approach to a body of work we all know very well, sort of looking at what was motivating the man behind these iconic movies at any given point in his life. Plus, it's just an excuse to revel in some of the most iconic and memorable films ever made, often from a sort of unexpected new angle. So I found it highly enjoyable, and I think anyone who's ever enjoyed a Spielberg film, which I imagine is just about everyone, would also find it so. So Spielberg, it's on HBO. If you have HBO Go or Now, you can check it out on that platform.
Awesome.
Tasha, what about you?
Well, I was actually going to talk up Brawl in Cell Block 99, but Scott stole my thunder. So
you had to know it. You had to know it was coming.
I knew it was coming. So I'm going to go with some lovers instead of some fighters. Professor Marston and the Wonder Women just hit theaters. And this is a movie about the man who created Wonder Woman, the character, who the original version of the character was. There was a lot of bondage in the comics. There was a lot of heavy implication of lesbian romance. There was a lot of like fetishy stuff that people who were in the fetish scene could recognize that was kind of coded for children. But it was always sort of a little bit salacious and a lot controversial. And it's kind of amazing the history that this comic came out of. But it's even more amazing the personal history that it came out of. This is about his relationship with his wife and another woman who they formed a long-term stable triad relationship with each other during a period where such things were completely inconceivable. They're barely conceivable today. But one of the things that this film addresses is the difficulty of navigating an unconventional relationship in a world that very much expects conventional relationships, and the difficulty of creating unconventional art in a popular medium that was kind of centered around a very few certain kinds of art. With Wonder Woman enjoying such a cultural moment, this has a really interesting kind of tie into the zeitgeist. But just in and of itself, it's a really artful film. The writer-director, Angela Robinson, is a queer Black woman, and she kind of brings her experience with racism and with sexism and with judgment and with homophobic attitudes into this story. But she doesn't overplay it. I think one of the things that's most interesting about this movie is that, in a way, it's a biopic that's almost mainstream acceptable, but but that is fairly fearless about portraying the sexuality and the kink that these three individuals were involved in. And it makes it all seem warm and playful. It's one of those movies that makes sex seem fun, mm-hmm. that acknowledge that sexual relationships are neither intensely passionate things that happen one time and then you run off together into the north to avoid being hunted down as replicants, or sort of things that you don't really think about because you're in a long-term relationship. It makes sex into a fun and important part of a relationship and a fun and important part of the film. I really recommend seeing this film for a lot of reasons, one of which is supporting a film that's all about representation in a variety of ways. But I also recommend it because it's really enjoyable. The acting is great. The storytelling is great. The imagery is great. I just really enjoyed Professor Marston and the Wonder Woman.
I'm glad to hear that, because that's such a fascinating story, and I wasn't sure that it would translate well into a movie. I wasn't sure how you would translate it into a movie, frankly. So, cool. We're going long, so I'll be fast. I got two quick recommendations. One is the film Lucky, which is Harry Dean Stanton's last film, and it is terrific. It is, I believe, his second starring role, right?
Paris, Texas. Mm-hmm.
And he plays Lucky, who's sort of this small-town guy who's in his 90s, as Stanton lived to be. And there's no conflict in it. It's basically a man who realizes he's not dead yet. And what does it all mean? And it's kind of inspiring into someone who's you know, late in his life, still asking questions, you know, still pondering life, still kind of drawing from his past and trying to turn things over. All this kind of play with a character who says very little and does very little, isn't very expressive. Because it's Stanton, though, it's a wonderful performance. You get to really get to know this guy over the course of the film. It's got a great supporting cast. David Lynch plays his buddy. Others, Ron Livingston, Ed Begley Jr., Tom Skerritt. He's got a great scene with Tom Skerritt where they bond over their war experiences. And you realize that Tom Skerritt at 84 is a little too young to have served in World War II, but Harry Dean Stanton actually did serve in World War II. But it's a really great swan song, directed by John Carroll Lynch, who is, in his own right, I mean, a terrific character actor. You know, it's sort of one character actor paying tribute to another in other ways. So that's Lucky. And I don't know. It's probably drifting around art houses still a little bit. It should be. I'm guessing it's a Magnolia release, which they usually comes out on home video fairly quickly, but it's not on VOD yet. So look for it soon if you haven't had a chance to check it out. Another one very quickly is would make a nice double feature with It. It's a film called Super Dark Times. It's very Stephen King influenced. It's the first feature from a director named Kevin Phillips. And it's kind of set in the mid-90s. And it's about these, I don't want to give too much away, but it's about these kids who have sort of kind of a losers club type thing going on the verge of adolescence, on the verge of moving on to that next thing. Something bad happens. I'll just leave it at that. And well, I feel like the end of this film, it's very technically well done. It kind of drops the ball a little bit, only because it simplifies what up to then has been this very complex and real portrayal of adolescence and all these like sort of walking around with, you know, feelings you don't want to have, relationships shifting in ways that you don't want them to. You're put in situations that you're just not mature enough to deal with. Yeah, it's really quite strong debut. I'm looking forward to more things from Kevin Phillips. The young cast, which includes like Charlie Trahan, Owen Campbell, and Elizabeth Cappuccino, who played young Jessica Jones and Jessica Jones, are all people to watch out for. So I'd recommend them both. Well, Lucky maybe just a little bit more, but they're both worth checking out. And Super Dark Times had a very short run in art houses. It's on VOD now.
Yeah, I saw Super Dark Times and had some mixed feelings, particularly about the third act, but I'm really looking forward to this director's next film because the guy has got a lot of talent.
Yeah, visually, it opens with this amazing imagery of the aftermath of a deer having run into a high school's window, and it sets this tone that kind of carries over through the rest of the film. It's, it's nicely done.
Definitely.
Man, it sounds like everything is coming up Stephen King these days.
It really is. It really is.
Well, that's it for this week's edition of The Next Picture Show. Our next episodes come out October 31st and November 2nd. Genevieve, what are we discussing?
Our next episodes will focus on two films about the relationship between different generations, starring the same actor, a pairing that puts him on both sides of the generational divide. First, we'll look at Mike Nichols' The Graduate, a film that gave us several memorable catchphrases, an immortal Simon and Garfunkel song, and made a star of Dustin Hoffman, who plays a recent college graduate adrift in the materialistic world of his parents. Then we'll follow the Hoffman thread to Noah Baumbach's new The Meyerowitz Stories, New and Selected, in which Hoffman plays the aging patriarch of a deeply divided New York family. Ben Stiller and Adam Sandler co-star as half-brothers who have to reckon with their father's legacy, tangible and otherwise. Meyerowitz is a Netflix exclusive and can be streamed there, while The Graduate is streaming on Filmstruck and available for digital rental on the usual providers, not to mention on several generations' worth of physical media, including a feature-packed Criterion Blu-ray.
In the meantime, we'd love to hear your feedback on this week's discussion of Blade Runner, Blade Runner 2049, and anything else film-related. We want to include your thoughts on future episodes of the show. You can leave a short voicemail at 773-234-9730 or email us at comments@nextpictureshow.net. Finally, before we close out this week's episode, where can we find everyone these days? Keith?
You can find me at uprocks.com, where I'm editorial director of film and television and writing when I can. And you can find me online at Twitter at kfip3000. Scott?
You can find me on Twitter at @Scott_Tobias, and you can find my work in the New York Times. I just did a piece on the killing of a sacred deer for Washington Post. You can find me on NPR and Variety, and I've been doing a little bit more for Vulture. I've got some Mindhunter recaps happening, and then I did a big list for our former coworker, now movies editor of the Vulture, Rachel Handler. I did a piece, a list of Man versus Nature movies, ranked them 25, definitive ranking. What about you, Genevieve?
You can find me at the Vox Culture section and on Twitter at Genevieve Kosky. Tasha?
You can find me at Twitter at Tasha Robinson. You can find me at The Verge, where I am the film and TV editor and also the interviewer of the director of Brawl in Cell Block 99. I enjoyed that interview, and I hope you enjoy it and enjoy the movie. You can stay updated on The Next Picture Show by visiting nextpictureshow.net, via Twitter at nextpicturepod, and via Facebook at facebook.com/nextpictureshow. And if you haven't subscribed to the show on Apple Podcasts already, please consider it. Apple Podcast subscriptions are an important part of getting podcasts more prominence and more listeners. While you're there, we appreciate every rating and review. We slobber over them like rabid dogs. Thanks to Colin the Animal Griffith for his assistance producing the show, and thanks to Delmark Records for providing recording space at their home base, Riverside Studios. The Next Picture Show is proud to be part of the Film Spotting family of podcasts and the Panoply Network. Please tune in next time. I'm almost